Coming up next, we have Mac Break Weekly with Andy Anatko, Serenity Caldwell, and Ashley Nelson Hornstein. We're talking about Apple Music, the new Steve Jobs trailer, and is Safari the new Internet Explorer?
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 462 for Tuesday, July 7, 2015. Your Mudda's cloud service.
Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit lynda.com/macbreak. That's lynda.com/macbreak. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple product is worth at gazelle.com.
It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we talk about Apple news, iPhone news, iPad news, Apple Watch news, all the news that is fit to print from Cupertino. Joining me this week, Leo Laporte is on vacation, but we still have The Rock, the foundation of the show, Andy Anatko from the Chicago Sun-Times. How are you, Andy?
Ray, I'm concerned that it sounds a lot like we're not going to talk about iPods this week for like the nth time ever.
We are. We actually are going to talk about iPods this week, Andy.
Holy cats. Thank you. Okay, good. Whew. I've got like a year and a half worth of stuff to talk about, and it's going to be a good show. Great. Thank you.
We have 30 seconds set aside for you in the third block, Andy. I hope you can run with it. Also joining us, we have Serenity Caldwell from iMore. How are you, Serenity?
Hi, I'm doing well. It's very, very humid in Boston. I feel like I give a weather report every time I come on Mac Break, so I might as well continue. It's very humid here. I'm very grateful for air conditioning.
It went from minus 30 here to about 80 Fahrenheit in what feels like the blink of an eye. It's just wrong.
Oh, boy.
The world is wrong. Also joining us for the first time, I've had the privilege of podcasting with her before, but I believe this is her first time on the Twit Network. Previously from Apple, currently at Dropbox, Ashley. How are you, Ashley?
I'm doing really well. Thanks, Renee.
Thank you so much for joining us.
My first time on Twit, but it's funny. I used to listen to this in high school, so... Well, at least this went intact. So it's pretty fun to be on this network now.
And you came back from vacation, landed a few minutes ago, and immediately joined us, which is awesome.
Yeah, happy to.
All right. So starting off, there was an article that created a lot of ripples in the Apple sphere. And it was an article that was, I think, deliberately provocative is a good way of setting it up. It was an article about Apple and Safari. Safari famously comes from KHTML, which was a Linux-based web browser. It became WebKit, and Apple made the Safari browser on top of WebKit. And now the charge has been made that Apple and WebKit are no longer really good internet citizens, that they do not support the most current standards, things that are, in essence, designed to make web apps function more like native applications. And the provocative charge was that Safari is becoming the new Internet Explorer. Some people are saying that, you know, that's not the right analogy, that what Safari is doing may not be good, but it's actually different than Internet Explorer. But Andy, you've been using browsers, I'm guessing, for quite a while. Do you have a take on this?
Yeah, I mean, I was reading it, and as always, when you're talking about fundamental core web browser technologies, my usual response is to nod thoughtfully and then email a bunch of people I know who actually developed for the web. And I mean, this piece, I've read it a few times, and he lands a few points. There's maybe a larger question that every single browser needs to sort of... kind of needs to suit the needs of the internet in general, and that real good change does not happen until you have a standard that can elevate every single web app that's out there. And but you're not going to get that to happen unless all the core players support it. For instance, like imagine to put it one way, imagine that Flash were actually good and actually healthy for people and doesn't wind up tearing out big chunks of your frontal lobe every time you try to use Flash content. Imagine it was actually important, but then imagine that Apple decided that, no, we're not going to support it. That means that it's not only bad for Safari users, but it's also bad for that standard as well, because developers are not going to want to target it if they know that one of the most popular browsers on the planet isn't going to use it. However, my larger view is that wow, there's so much CRUD inside the browser already, and there are so many competing standards that I want a more streamlined, more efficient platform, not a more complicated one. And so although it's very, very important for the browser to stop being just simply a way to display content and to start being an actual active app platform, Apple doesn't necessarily have to do that by destabilizing its browser and making sure they're adopting every single standard that's being proposed, as good as those standards are. And the reason why they don't necessarily have to do that is because there's Chrome, Google Chrome, which is an exceptionally good browser that is very ambitious in supporting standards. And if there is a standard that needs to be supported and Google supports it, well, that's that checked off the list. And if it turns out that Safari users are getting sort of pushed to the back because there's an app standard that is not being supported, Apple knows that. Apple has tried it. Apple has implemented it. Apple has definitely thought about it. And the reason why they're not supporting it right now is not because they're trying to be no good nicks. It's because they simply don't believe in it. But if it becomes a popular standard, as proven through the Chrome browser, Safari will have it very, very quickly. So interesting food for thought, but I thought it was pretty much a non-issue.
Just to name some of the services that it's Nolan Lawson who wrote the article, and I had a couple nice Twitter conversations with him, and he's been actively talking to the Safari team. So it's not like he's just someone who wants to yell and throw, you know, rotten fruit at Apple. So basically, there's Service Worker, which lets you have background tasks so the browser can send notifications. There's Web Components, which are reusable widgets for the web. There's Shadow DOM, which means that you don't have to cram everything into the main document object model of the web. You can just make subsets of that can do specifically encapsulated and isolated things. And there's Manifest, which is a centralized metadata repository for web apps. There are other things, like there's been errors. I forget what's called ID Base. It's a database service, I believe, for the web that Apple has been either slow or not prioritized in developing. Ashley, Dropbox is both a web platform and a native app platform. Do you have a feeling one way or another?
I thought this was a really thoughtful piece. It's interesting. I sort of like what Andy brought up about the fact that Safari's leveraging Chrome as their guinea pig, are the testing ground, so to speak, and letting them sort of prove out whether or not these are standards they should even adopt. I know internally in Dropbox, you know, we have to support Internet Explorer, Safari, and Chrome. And I haven't heard too many rumblings about support not being offered in one browser or the other. So this piece actually a little bit surprised me. I can tell you personally, I picked up Safari and became a user while working at Apple. It was sort of encouraged, I would say, by my coworkers. And only recently, within the past 2 weeks, have I actually switched to Chrome for work. I honestly, it was just a speed thing. I just found, I know the tests sort of prove that, or I've seen tests and statistics that say that Safari is fast, right? But I wasn't finding that in my own personal use. And so I find the timeliness of this article to be most appropriate given like my recent switch back to Chrome. So it's interesting.
One of the interesting things that I saw was that, you know, people think it's strange to think that Apple has limited resources because they're one of the richest companies, most successful companies in the world. But there's a limit to those engineers. An engineer can't work on feature A and feature B at the same time. So they have to make choices. And some of Apple's Safari members have spoken about this and said that they didn't have time to prioritize some of the things that were on this list. But they did do things like iCloud Keychain, like Safari WebView, like the extensions for content blockers. Ren, is there a difference maybe between the priorities of a company like Apple and our priorities of a company like Google or Firefox?
I think every company is going to have their own priorities and their own focuses that they believe are their tier one, you know, top of the line issues. A company like Apple is very, very interested and focused on security. And obviously they're focused on making sure that they have a fast and strong, stable platform. And I feel like with WebKit and everything else, they've constantly been pushing the bar and pushing the envelope when it comes to Safari. And unfortunately, I mean, we see this in iBooks. We see this in iBooks, which is basically a WebKit skin over sort of the EPUB framework, where, you know, iBooks Author is a great example of something where the EPUB framework wasn't where Apple wanted it to be, so they added a bunch of custom specialty CSS classes that no other browser can read and no other ebook reader can read because they wanted to do special things that they just could not do, could not build with the standard framework. So I don't necessarily think it's, you know, it's Apple or it's the, you know, these other folks going away from the standard and eschewing the standard, saying poo poo to it. I think it's very much, we want to try these new things and we want to experiment. And sometimes the standard takes a little bit of time and we are 100% committed to the standard. But at the same time, you know, we're not going to stop innovating just to wait on a standard, you know, checkbox to get checked so that it comes down the pipeline.
Do any of you think it's a problem? Sorry to interrupt, but do any of you think it's a problem that Apple isn't sending representatives to these conferences? Because that seems to be one of the main points of contention, just like sort of representation or being at the table, an interest in being at the table.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting to me because I know they definitely used to send reps to the EPUB conferences and the W3C conferences. I saw that in the article as well, and that kind of that shocked me a little bit that they're not interested or not.
I think they didn't go to this conference. They still do the standards. They do face to face for the standard stuff, but they didn't go to a conference. This one, I forget the name now. It was, I'll find it here. Something Edge and. EdgeCon.
But what bothers me is that I remember when there used to be a really great developer conference before WWDC called Mac Hack, and lots of Apple engineers used to attend that conference. And they weren't giving keynotes, they weren't giving presentations. They were just in t-shirts, part of these 200 or 300 people hanging around a pretty miserable Michigan Michigan hotel room. And the thing is, it's not just about them being there for new standards. It's that they're having those sort of like person-to-person interactions that happen totally randomly. And over the course of 3 days, they're going to learn things about how people are interacting with their software that they wouldn't have heard. People are going to be saying things that are very, very truthful to them that they wouldn't hear otherwise. And also they have the opportunity, without flying the banner of Apple behind them, they're just employees of a big company that decided to spend the registration fee for this conference. They can also communicate back that here's the problems that we're facing and what ideas do you have? And even if it doesn't result in physical features and physical fixes, there is a great benefit to the perception that, well, you know what, I talked to one of the lead developers at Mac Hack last year. I know they're aware of this. I know that it's not that they don't care. It's not that they're pursuing a different agenda. But so let's keep our fingers crossed. You can call it a form of PR, but sometimes PR is actually a good thing when you're a company that's this big.
And I will say they don't always announce it, but if you do go to a lot of conferences, you will see Apple people there, whether you know it or not. And maybe, you know, yeah. I don't know if anyone actually went to this conference, but more and more often lately, especially, there are Apple people there. They're just in their Clark Kent and Diana Prince disguises. So you don't see them. And one of the other criticisms here, though, is that Apple doesn't allow other. Like, so, for example, on your Mac, you can just use Chrome if you want to support those web technologies. But on iOS, regardless of who makes the browser, even Chrome on iOS, you have to use Apple's rendering engine. They don't allow third-party rendering engines. So that iOS basically is an island. And if Apple doesn't support the web technologies there, that's hundreds of millions of people who don't have access to them. And for the people. And I will say that, you know, if you're a web developer, you have a hammer, everything is a nail. You want everything to be a super great web app, even when maybe a super great web app is not the best solution for that particular problem. But their point of view is that by limiting the selection of browser engine, Apple sort of has this walled off garden on iOS.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And especially troubling when you look at the numbers at exactly how much news and other content are being consumed, not just on phones, but on iOS devices. They really do have like the 800-pound Godzilla position in this industry. So if they're making any moves that lock them into an Apple-branded browser, or maybe even worse, try to encourage them to use an Apple-branded news gathering and news reading app, that does give them sort of a weird advantage that maybe they shouldn't have. It's not as troubling with Apple as with other companies, because I think they have a very good track record of at the beginning and the end of every day, they decide what is the best thing for our users. How can we make the best experience possible? They're willing to deny users choice toward that end, but they are working towards their goals. But I agree. I think that's very, very troubling when you cannot just simply decide that I want to have a different rendering engine. I want to make sure that I can access the information I want through the app that I want. Because if Apple was able to hasten the demise of Flash simply by not supporting it on the hottest mobile device that was out there, that wasn't necessarily a bad thing, but again, what happens if they if they're not interested in something that really is in consumers' best interests?
Yeah, it's interesting to me, and you know, maybe this hits closest to home for you, Ashley, but we saw WebKit basically get unbundled, where suddenly you had APIs and HTTP access to web information, but it was presented in native apps. So you sort of had the browser was initially the way that every bit of web content, FTP and a couple other things aside, was consumed. And yeah, there was even FTP clients for the web browser. But now you can have a weather app that pulls from Yahoo's weather API, but it's not in a browser. And you can have messaging services that are in apps and not in browsers. And now that's happening even with UIKit apps. So with extensibility, Dropbox is an app on iOS, but thanks to the extension, I can move stuff around without ever actually opening the Dropbox app now. So I wonder, this push for native web browsers, is this sort of becoming an anachronism? Will we really need web browsers or even bundled apps in the future? Or is everything going to sort of just be discrete functionality that we can call up from everywhere?
I would love to move to a point where we can just have sort of that, you know, if I think it's sort of what we're seeing with multitasking, where what I need from a particular app, it can provide it. And then I'm done with that app. I mean, like you said, I may not even need to open Dropbox app if I just need to access it as a file storage provider. So I think that could be really, really amazing. I think one of the most exciting things I saw in iOS 9 is being able to open a web browser directly from my app without having to move to Safari. Will we ever get to a point where we don't even need web browsing or even need Safari? I can't see that happening. I am excited about sort of the fact that we can authorize the Dropbox app and move from, you know, a link directly into the app without having to go to Safari anymore. Like, I think that's just going to provide a much better and richer customer experience. And I think to Andy's point that that's sort of the direction we're going to head. It's going to be totally based on whether or not it benefits the user's experience or not, rather than just cutting out an app just for cutting it out sake.
Yeah, it's super interesting. It's contrasting what I just asked Andy about whether, you know, you can't set different default apps, you can't use different rendering engines. So, Andy, on the iPhone, with this new Safari View controller, you basically get an embedded version of Safari. Apple's clearly focusing on making that the experience. And arguably, if you change defaults or you had a different rendering engine, as Safari becomes a view rather than a separate web browser, you wouldn't benefit from that anyway.
Yeah, no, I actually think it's a really awesome thing that they're doing with iOS 9 in terms of integrating the view controller. I know some people are a little bit iffy on it. They like their custom implementations. But to me, the ability to get access to your iCloud keychain and to have that integrated, to have, you know, all of the speed boosts and everything that comes with Safari, the security that comes with Safari, and not have to use MK Web Viewer or anything complicated like that to display web pages in your app, I think that's a huge win. Both for users and for developers. It makes it easier for developers. Now, will some developers still want to make their own custom views? Probably. But I think the majority of developers should be very well treated by this, especially on the iPad. When you think about iPad browsing and the ability to make custom shortcut keyboards, I could see, you know, being able to use that and connect with it's read-only, the Safari View controller, right? In apps?
I believe so.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, it's going to be, if nothing else, I'm super happy that stuff like this comes up and that we have these discussions, because the direction of the web going, it was almost like this thing Apple tradition. There's a story that when Apple was trying to figure out how to make the SDK for the iPhone, they considered several things, bringing AppKit over from the Mac, using WebKit as the interface. And they decided that neither of those things were a good solution. And they made UIKit, which is a native framework. WebOS famously used WebKit as their framework, and it was just never fast enough. And they always say the web is getting faster. We need to make the web faster. But as fast as the web gets, those same underlying architectures makes native even faster. And with things like Swift, native is developing faster too. And to, you know, Don Melton, famously, who ran WebKit and Safari at Apple, did one of his calm the expletive down tweets about all this, saying they're two different tools and you need to have both in your tool set. But Andy, I think that's the most important part of this, is that we have this discussion from time to time and sort of reevaluate our own preconceptions.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking back for some reason to news that came out of this really, really hush-hush intelligence conference, where a lot of the big players in digital and also in government spy agencies were coming together and talking about amongst other things, the Snowden revelations. And one of the things that came out of that conference was that the fact that there was so much discussion that came out from the public about these revelations means that we're not talking enough about what we're doing. We need to disclose more. We need to be more upfront, and we need to think about what we're actually doing. And the application to this situation is that the more Apple can be seen to discuss these things, maybe they'll do things that you don't necessarily approve of, but you will understand and trust the reasons why they're doing it at the very least. And that's why discussion is so valuable.
No, I think that's absolutely true. One of the other interesting bits of news that came out on July 1st, Johnny Ive assumed his role of chief design officer at Apple in the updated Apple.com. It's fun to
basically,
say.
Basically, after everything I look about this, I see him just like putting his stovetop hat, his pan on the top of his head, slinging a bag of apple seeds, and just walking barefoot across the entire world, spreading design. It was a really majestic sort of description of someone who certainly has a lot to do, but they're not really explaining what it is he's going to have to be doing.
I thought it was great because they made a very subtle update to Apple.com, but they also added bios for the two people who are basically replacing him as day-to-day managers of Apple, the new vice president. And that's Alan Dye, who's taking over Human Interface, the HI group, and Richard Howarth, who's taking over Industrial Design, the ID group. But it caused a bit of a kerfuffle because on the internet, it says that they are on Apple.com. It says that they're reporting to Tim Cook and not Johnny Ive. And a couple of things sort of stood out at me there. One is that all the vice presidents listed on Apple.com report to Tim Cook. Ken Ferry on Twitter pointed out that Steve Jobs only had one direct report, and that was Steve Wozniak. And Steve Wozniak had no direct reports, and everyone else went technically to Tim Cook. And Apple strategy, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but Apple, it just doesn't see org charts the way other companies do, I think. And it's dangerous to sort of read into what they put on Apple.com.
Absolutely. Apple.com is designed to showcase for the shareholders, and it's designed to showcase for the media, basically. It's not really designed to if Apple really wanted to roll out here's how our management structure works and here are lines and here they could, but they're not going to. Their management structure, I feel like, is just as much not necessarily a trade secret, but is part of what makes Apple Apple. It's part of how they build their company. And just because you have, they report directly to Tim Cook, that means Johnny Ive is thinking about retiring. No, it means they're vice presidents. All the VPs talk to Tim Cook. That's how it works. They're VPs.
Johnny Cerugi, who runs chipsets, doesn't report to Dan Riccio. He reports to Tim Cook. It is interesting, but I think it's hard to make a case, whatever you feel about Johnny Ive, whether you feel this is him starting to retire or him going in a different direction and maybe assuming more responsibility, whether you think this is some elaborate plan to hide his salary from Wall Street, or you think it's just a way to make him content and happy to continue his job. I think Apple.com, you work there, Ashley. I think Apple.com is never a good way to assess any of this stuff.
No, absolutely. I think Serena hit it right on the head in terms of, it's for shareholders, it's for media, it's to sort of placate the people responsible for our stock price and make sure, their stock price, and make sure that there's no panic. I do think it is interesting though, that they're reporting to Tim, but I feel like that's an organizational thing. Like maybe Tim writes their performance reviews at the end of the year or something. If we're under the auspicion that Johnny is sort of accepting or taking on a little bit less responsibility or a little bit less of the management responsibility, as was in one of those articles recently, then I think it makes perfect sense that he wouldn't. They wouldn't directly report to him in a managerial structure.
And Renee, does Apple still do that weekly, upper executive all hands meeting?
You mean the one that lets people not watch TV on Sunday nights because they're busy? I've not heard specifically, but I imagine they do.
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but I remember hearing things about how there's not a whole lot of barriers between people who work in different senior vice presidents being able to collaborate and meet together. So they're all kind of, I interpret that as to mean that they were all sort of reporting to Tim Cook directly anyway, in that they're just people in a room talking about here's week to week, here's what the status of pretty much every project and how the pieces are fitting together. So I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's hard to think that Apple without a deliberate organization chart is one without organization, or one that that looks like it's that people are being pushed out. The take that I always had about Johnny Ive was that this new description of his role allows him to design everything, as opposed to being really stuck in a more formal structure. It's unusual for me to see someone who is that creative stay in the same job for that many years. People just get that itch, even if they have the dream job at Pixar, the dream job at ILM, the dream job at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. There's something about that kind of brain that says, I've been doing the same thing for 11 years now. I want to design coffee pots for Target, because that's going to be really interesting for me for the next 3 or 4 years. So
it's interesting, does Johnny just pop in and out of design meetings, or would you just get an email? I wonder, like you said, he sort of ostensibly gets to oversee sort of all design of Apple now, right? So if you're making a mock-up and you're a designer, might you get an email from Johnny because he saw something and wants you to tweak it or something? Like, there's no limit sort of to his oversight, we think. So I wonder what that means practically. I guess we'll find out over the next couple of years.
He just apparates, apparently. It's something that all British designers can do. But to Andy's point, I think that's absolutely true, because we've seen what happens with incredibly talented people when they sort of have no constraints or inspiration left. And you become like Bill Watterson, who feels like your work is done and you retire and your magnificent legacy is behind you. Or you decide you no longer need editing and you start making a bunch of crazy products and prequels that people are really baffled by. And neither of those are really good. I'm happy that Johnny Ive is doing this, for example, rather than having something awkward happen where an Apple product comes out that's just completely zany. Although there is news that all Apple stores are revamping with third-party accessory selection, Serenity. These ones designed by Apple. So like your Mophie, the box for your Mophie juice pack could have come out of Cupertino now instead of Mophie headquarters.
So this is a little bit crazy to me. This actually feels like a Steve Jobs move. I have to admit, like an old world Apple move, where it's back to the, we want to control every aspect of the customer experience, right? Where I actually totally get Apple saying to accessory manufacturers, yo, you know, we're selling this in the store and some of this packaging is terrible and environmentally unfriendly and impossible to open. And let's talk about incorporating some packaging aspects into the MFI program. That's how I feel like this conversation actually went, where it's like, yeah, this is just this doesn't look great on our store shelves, and we'd like you to make better packaging. Is it actually confirmed that Apple is making the packaging? Because that's the part that rings false to me. I feel like them giving guidelines down to accessory manufacturers saying your packaging probably has to be made out of these materials and can only be fastened in these ways and has these colors, like, that makes sense to me. But Apple actually being like, we're going to package this, we're going to put aside some of our factories and take your third-party accessories. And
Sheila and Marcom's has too much time on her hands. Give her Mophie to eat.
Yeah, exactly. It rubs a little wrong for me.
Yeah, like as device manufacturers, our margins are so great, we got nothing but time and budget to design a better box. But that is absolutely true, though. I mean, that just the stuff that's. I got product boxes just like stacked up in my office, and you know, here's the box that Apple's wristwatch comes in, and you could put your eye out on this, and it's just it's such a sharp and it's such a tight tolerance that it just does not want to come apart, and yet right next to it, again, that did not plan this, but here is the box that Motorola's flagship phone comes in, and it's a perfectly fine box, but it's something that pretty much anything could come in, and it doesn't really convey this is a really wonderful special object, which the Moto X actually is. And you could certainly make the case that, look, it's just a box, you're gonna hold on to this for a couple of weeks until you realize you don't need to throw it away, and then unless you know you're gonna sell this on Gazelle in a year or two, you're probably gonna throw it out. But it is part of what communicates the entire consumer experience. And so long as it's not pushing some of these device manufacturers and accessory manufacturers into an early grave, if they could impart a little bit of design wisdom on here's how to make packaging that really makes your customer really, really happy that they gave you $60 for this iPad easel, all to the better.
Andy, I love how you just have those boxes right next to you, just hanging out.
There's a real advantage to like not removing clutter. It's nice to be lazy sometimes. This is the one case out of like 2 months where I could say, you see, there's a reason why I never throw everything out and just keep it heaped up on that little desk over there.
You were wrong, A&E. You were wrong.
See, Mom, I didn't have to clean my room.
We're going to take a quick break because I know that Leo Laporte, even though he is on vacation, even though he and Lisa are flooding our Instagrams with the most beautiful pictures imaginable, he still had time to stop by and tell us about something amazing.
Hey, don't let me interrupt. All right, let me interrupt. Wait a minute. I'm going to interrupt because we got to pay the bills here. We'll be back with more of MacBreak Weekly in just a little bit, but I've stopped by to remind you that MacBreak Weekly is brought to you by our good friends at Lynda, LYNDA.com. I think the Lynda audience is all of us, people who want to learn, who want to solve problems, want to get better at our work, better at our play. You want to make things happen? You can learn how at Lynda.com. Take better photos, develop an iOS app, master Excel, sharpen your HTML skills. That's it. Lynda.com has over 3,000 on-demand video courses that will teach you anything your curious mind might want to know. They just released a brand new series of courses on the Creative Cloud. Did you just get your update? I did. The 2015 Creative Cloud. This is one of the things Lynda does that's so cool. They work directly with the software publishers. So when the new version comes out, they're ready. They've got the courses already ready to go. Of course, their teachers are the best. They're people who work in the business. Great teachers like Burt Monroy. Many of our friends, many people you see on Twit. I mean, imagine learning Photoshop from Burt Monroy. You don't get better than that. They've got tutorials now on the new Creative Cloud. Photoshop, Premiere Pro, Audition. Use that for years. Love Audition. After Effects, InDesign, and Illustrator. And talk about on top of it, they've just released a first look at developing for Apple Watch, which is awesome. That's how on top of it they are. They, you know, Apple's WWDC was, what, 2 weeks ago? Lynda.com. I've been doing the photo stuff because I just want to be a better photographer and taking courses from friends like Ben Long, who really can help you get a better grip on your creative talents. Oh, it's so great. You can watch and learn from the best in the business, people who are great teachers, who are working in the business. They're beautifully produced video courses. You can stream them whenever you want, on your schedule, wherever you want, on your iOS or Android device, on your desktop. You can also learn at your own pace. You know, you don't have to watch the courses from beginning to end. They're structured in such a way that you can do that, but you can also watch little bite-sized chunks or look at the transcripts and jump right to the part you want. I am a big fan, and I think you're going to find a course. Well, you know what? Here's the deal. Just go to lynda.com/MacBreak right now, and you'll have 10 days the run of the place. You can look at any video. You could take an entire course beginning to end if you want. You could just dip in a few of them. In fact, I would do that because there's so much great stuff there. It's a treasure trove. Your Lynda.com membership gives you unlimited access to training on hundreds of topics. It's one flat rate, and for the first 10 days, it's free at lynda.com/MacBreak. Whether you want to get a better job, whether you just want to spend time with your favorite thing in the world, whatever that might be, whether you want to become better at your hobby, this is the place for you. lynda.com/MacBreak. Try it today, will you? Now back to MacBreak Weekly.
You could not even tell Leo was in an ancient medieval European castle when he did that. That was amazing. Back to the news. We saw finally after the show yesterday, last week, iTunes 12.2 came out, which brought Apple Music to the Mac. We're going to talk about Apple Music some more in a little while. But one of the interesting things inside this new version of iTunes were images for iPods of previously unseen colors, Nanos, iPods Touch, iPods Shuffle, all the iPods, basically. And that led people to believe that Apple might once again rev the iPod, which has stayed unrevved in a curiously long amount of time. So what's interesting about this also is that I've heard that they're actually skipping a generation with the iPod. Instead of going to iPod 6.1, which would be the next iPod Touch in line, they're going to iPod 7.1. What happened to 6.1 is, I guess, a story for another day. But that sort of means that they're going to leapfrog technologies, because those numbers are usually, not always, but usually tied to processor generations. Right now, the iPod Touch, like the Apple TV, is stuck on an Apple A5 chip. It's a 32-bit chip in a now 64-bit world. So, Serenity, I am super excited if Apple clean shelf of all the 32-bit architecture, and we get maybe minimally at least an A7-powered iPod Touch this year.
Yes, please, God, yes. I was a little worried that the iPod Touch was done, that they were saying goodbye to it, sayonara. But I'm glad that it's not. I think with the launch of Apple Music, they definitely need something in the lineup that can hold those lovely Apple Music offline songs that isn't necessarily an iPod. Again, it's a way to, you know, even with an Android application, it's a way to get the younger generation, the folks who are using family sharing on Apple Music, on, you know, into the iOS ecosystem without having to pay for a phone and a subscription plan. I think that moving up to 64-bit architecture is a huge win. The more devices that we can get out of that hole, the better. And I'm really excited for the fancy colors. I kind of love collecting iPod shuffles. It's one of my secret collector's items, children's books and iPod shuffles. So I have a one from almost every generation. So I'm looking forward to maybe getting a gold iPod shuffle.
A table laminated in all the iPod shuffle colors.
Yeah.
Actually, I mean, they said that they were going to let developers target 64-bit only at WWDC, and there will be legacy devices like iOS 8 still supports the older iPod Touch and some of the older iPhones, like the 4S, the iPad 2 probably. Is it a big deal for you, for Apple to get their processor architecture all onto 64-bit?
Absolutely. I think I echo Serenity's excitement about sort of dropping the 32-bit options. I think, what is it, they're finally dropping iPad 2 support, which is nice, as well as iPhone, well, maybe not yet, iPhone 4S, I hope, support's going to be dropped as well. One of the interesting things to me is people always point to iPods as like the gateway for kids getting Apple devices, especially if they don't need an iPhone yet. But I guess maybe it's a different age range. Like, I always find kids around like maybe 10 and under want iPads. Like, they're most excited for that and like getting on YouTube and playing games on their iPads. Could anybody like anecdotally speak to if anybody in their families wants iPods? Because I sort of forgot they existed, to be honest.
I think primarily they want dad's or their big brothers or sisters' old iPhones. There's definitely a heritage thing sort of going down. But there's such a big opportunity, I think, for the iPods, the entire line that exist right now that weren't there just a few years ago. As Renee said, I mean, remember that I think one of the first reasons why Apple even introduced an iPod Shuffle was that was back when the iTunes store was all under DRM. And so you can go into any drugstore and buy a really decent $50, $60, $70, $80 MP3 player. Apple needed to be able to sell people cheap MP3 players that would be able to play the stuff that they sold. So Apple Music makes it a lot more relevant. But also there's the health app. That makes it's a whole new ballgame for this sort of stuff. I mean, I think that it would be really, really great if Apple extended the benefits of the health app to people who can't necessarily afford a $300 or $400 watch, and to put the right sort of sensors inside a $75 or $100 iPod Shuffle. And not only will it be able to play all that content from the Apple Store, but will also be able to do all that motion capture sort of stuff. It will also be able to be a sleep tracker and stuff like that, and then sync back to the phone later on when you bring it close to the phone. That's just such a huge win for everybody. So there's just such great opportunity for the iPod now.
Anecdotally, my godkids really wanted the iPod Touch when it came out. We ended up getting them for their birthdays a couple of years ago. But last time we were going to update them, because there weren't new iPod Touches, we got them iPad Minis. And they love the big screen, but they really liked the camera on the iPod Touch because it was so convenient for them to run around holding it almost like a real camera. And you do have advantages and pros and cons. And if the iPad Mini cannibalizes the iPod Touch, I don't think Apple cares, but I think it's interesting to have that back in the market. The only thing I'm not sure of, Serenity, is what Apple Music and DRM will mean for iPods. I mean, the iPod Touch will be fine. It's an internet device, but the iPod Nano and the iPod Shuffle, these aren't devices born of iCloud. The Apple Watch has taken on a little bit of that. You know, you can go running with your Apple Watch instead, but how do old school tethered to iTunes devices exist in it or live or survive or succeed in an Apple Music world?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, the iPod Touch is different than the other iPods in that it has an internet connection. So it's able to work on that regard and connect to the internet, download things from Apple Music. The Shuffles and the Nanos, it's a question of, obviously we've seen, you know, the promo artwork for future Shuffles and future Nanos. But that is a big question to me. How long offline music is allowed to exist, whether or not there will be, maybe it's a Bluetooth connect, like maybe we'll see iPods with Bluetooth radios that allow it to sort of do an authentication check with a Wi-Fi device and also remove the tethering problem from say syncing your Shuffle to your Mac. I think that would be really cool. I mean, we've seen Bluetooth LE type playlist sharing and transfer with the watch. So I'm kind of like crossing my fingers. I just don't know if adding in a Bluetooth LE antenna would be cost prohibitive to those smaller, cheaper devices. But that's how I'd potentially see Apple Music working on those other ones. We also don't, Apple hasn't said how long offline music will last or will stay until, you know, obviously it needs authentication from the servers every so often to know that you still have a subscription. I'm suspecting it's probably once every 30 days. At least that makes sense in my head. I don't know if that's actually going to be the truth, but we'll see.
I don't know if this is sort of the resurgence of the iPod or the last hurrah, because they didn't update them for, I think, 3 years. I think 2012 was when they last updated them. And this is mostly a color reflection and a bump for the iPod Touch. So I like what you're saying, Andy. I think that there's immense value in having those. I just don't know if Apple sees the Apple Watch as sort of maybe lowering the Apple Watch lineup down instead of building back up the iPod lineup.
No, I don't think so, especially when you talk about the iPod Shuffle. Given that they can do, the FOB price on Bluetooth LE is shockingly low, and I don't even want to know what Apple would pay for it. If Apple, I'm not going to, it's stupid for anybody to say what Apple should and shouldn't do. I can only say that as a user and as an enthusiast, that if Apple were to simply say, we're going to sort of take the curse off of, we're going to really underscore how important we're saying the health app is by giving people a really cheap buy-in to have access to that app. And if they simply said that we're going to reintroduce, let's forget about the entire rest of the iPod line, we're just going to re-up the Shuffle, we're going to keep the price as far below $100 as possible, ideally 49, but 79 would do as well. And not only is it good for music content, not only is it that super lightweight music player that people want to wear while they're running or while they're exercising, but it will also be a fitness tracker for just the people who want to be reminded how many times they're getting up and getting down over the course of the day, how many steps are they walking every day. That would be so completely aligned with the message that Apple is sending about their mission on this planet, that I just, as I said, I'm not saying what they should or shouldn't do, but I'm saying that when I listen to what Apple is saying, how they choose to describe themselves, I keep hearing $79 iPod Shuffle with fitness trackers built into it is such a natural fit for that.
Hey, you think that would work, Ashley, if you put like an M2 or an M3 chip inside it and it had some form of the motion detecting technology and it could do the basic stuff for you? Would that be an interesting device?
No. For me, no. I totally, I mean, Andy's clearly passionate about the iPod and he's almost got me sold on its utility, but I just can't see worrying or caring about another device, especially the Shuffle. First off, I don't really listen to music that much, especially when I run. But I also am very particular about what I'm listening to or like what the cue is. Like I don't shuffle music or shuffle podcasts. So maybe I'm just not in the right use case for it. Honestly, there's a reason that I forgot the iPod exists. it's not that compelling to me. I don't mind bringing my iPhone on a run. So having another like more lightweight device to sync it just seems like an extra step that I wouldn't do.
It's interesting because there were rumors also about the iPhone 6S. Mark Gurman, with legendary sources in software and hardware, was basically and he's also gotten super smart now. So instead of dumping it all at once, he sort of strings us along for several days now. Has been revealing the innards of what's purportedly the iPhone 6S, and it's got much smaller, shrunken down chips, much simpler chips. Maybe simpler is not the right word, less numerous chipsets. And when you get to that sort of efficiency, I mean, it's great because you can get better battery life out of it and less radio interference and all sorts of wonderful things. But it also makes smaller devices much better, things that don't require the size of an iPhone or the size of that screen. And Ren, maybe that's sort of the future we're going at, and technologies that Apple's really good at leveraging technologies across the company, and what's helping them miniaturize things for the Apple Watch could be a sign of further miniaturization to come.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen jokes long ago about like the iPod ear. So it's so tiny and fits in your ear canal. I think that miniaturization is awesome. And the more work, honestly, the tweaking and the tinkering that they can do with the Nano and the Shuffle, I think will actually pay good dividends into the further development of the watch and vice versa. Because anytime you're trying to build really tiny devices, you're kind of working in the same ballpark and with the same sort of end goal in mind, even if one is more significantly advanced than the other. I don't know. I don't know if I would buy a Shuffle now because I have this guy. I don't know if I'd buy a Shuffle for regular use other than just to put it on my shelf and be like, yay, it's a Shuffle. It's awesome. But I can see people who do, you know, people who don't have an Apple Watch but want to track their fitness or want to listen to music while running or while out or, you know, just anything of the above. Don't want a $300 device on their wrist. I can definitely see the appeal. I think that there's a market for it. It's just a question of how far Apple really wants to go down that rabbit hole when everybody in the world is like, the iPod is dead. Although granted, they've said that about many other Apple products too. So
doomed. I like what Andy's saying though, because music as a service went from being the classic iPod, and then that became the Mini and the Nano and then the Shuffle. And even if Apple doesn't want to take the Apple Watch specifically down market, they might want to take aspects like health. Is that what you're saying, Andy?
Yeah, I'm basically saying that they've been saying this time and time again that health is look at how much space they gave the health app in the last keynote. I think they gave it a whole act of the show to explain exactly all the benefits they're doing. And health is one of those unusual beasties for an Apple keynote in that there is no real profit in it. It's a feature that makes other things look really, really cool. And as I said, I bet that that you guys have had the same sort of conversations with people inside Apple, that when they talk about this product, they're not running down. They're not talking about the chamfer angle on a case or a bezel. They're talking about how they can improve people's lives with health. And I do think that this would fit in very well with their mandate. I don't think it would cannibalize Apple Watch sales at all, because $350 minimum buy-in versus, again, ideally $79 minimum buy-in. And I have no knowledge of this inside Apple, but sometimes I wonder if there's a little bit of an itch in the design team to say, we would love to be able to design something that's really, really small and really, really affordable. Not for any sort of an altruistic reason necessarily, but it's a challenge that they've never had. They've never shown any proficiency at how good can we make something if we don't have to charge $3,000 for it? Are we up to that certain challenge? So that's something that's been in the back of my mind for a little while, because again, people who are in those sort of creative roles, they have weird motives and weird itches, and if you don't allow them to do stuff, if you don't allow them to pursue every avenue of their talent, they start to get a little antsy.
You know, I don't mean this disparagingly at all, but you just made me sort of picture this image of the Apple design team saying, the new iPhone's going to be half as thick, get your camera to fit in it. And the engineers just work really hard for a year and they manage to do it. And the next day the design team says, we're going to make it half as thin again, get your camera to fit in that. And it's sort of like that same thing. You ran the lap in 100 seconds, can you do it in 50 seconds? And that's sort of high performance people, as much as they hate that, they also love that.
It's interesting. I'm trying to skirt around I'm sorry. I'm going through a table of things and looking at what check marks have been put next to it of things that I should not be talking about publicly.
so you can say typhoon now. You can officially say typhoon today.
It would be interesting 30 years from now when people have been retired from Apple for 20 years to when just like the members of the original Mac team are now speaking completely freely and with great pride about all of the fights and all the struggles that outfitted and defined the original Macintosh. I would like to hear people who are working on the iPhone talk about getting those 2 millimeters thinner and if they actually thought what a great design challenge as opposed to there is no reason for us to take 2 millimeters off. And now you have totally screwed us over in these plans we had for the camera. We had so many things we could have done, but now we can't do because someone decided that it has to be thinner no matter what. It's going to be interesting to hear those stories in 10 or 20 years time when the statute of limitations, when finally when not only Apple's robots of vengeance, their batteries have died out and now they're rusting on the surface as we all live underground. But also the fear of the government that Apple morphed into in 2141 has also collapsed. People can finally talk about actually designing Apple products and all the fights that happen inside.
I love that conversation I talked about previously when Don Melton and Nitin Ganatra talked about the discussions about whether to use AppKit or WebKit or what eventually became UIKit as the foundation for development on that kind of stuff. It does eventually come out, and regardless of where you fit on, in what your personal opinion is, hearing those discussions and knowing that they had those discussions and it's not all arbitrary and maybe it wasn't the best solution, but it was the best one that they had at the moment, I think is hugely educational for people who watch Apple now.
That's what happens in all levels of design. I can talk about a different phone manufacturer where it had a similar problem. I am thinking specifically about the camera features, where they were just looking at different prototypes or looking at different things that they had built, and they realized that we can either use this camera module, which takes okay pictures, and will allow us to have that slim profile we're going for, and they're trying specifically to ape the iPhone 4 or the 4S, or we can swallow our pride, have a little bit of a bump up there, and give this a really, really good picture-taking hardware. And they decided people are going to make fun of us for having a blister on the other side of our phone, but the people who own this will forget about that about 10 seconds after they see their first pictures out of this. So the making of documentary behind almost anything, when it's being designed by really creative people, and almost everybody at that level is a highly creative person, fascinating stuff to watch.
So speaking of creative people, I understand that Leo Laporte has an additional segment he wants, or additional product he wants to tell us about. It's something almost equally or every bit as amazing.
Our show today, if you don't mind, I'd like to interrupt and remind you, our show today brought to you by Gazelle. You know about Gazelle. Best place to buy and sell your old gadgets. They will buy certified pre-owned iPhones, Samsung Galaxy phones, iPads, Surface tablets, Kindles, whatever you've got, they'll buy it at a great price. They pay the shipping on anything worth more than a buck. It's a great place to send your old device. But nowadays, you got to think of it more as like a trade-in because they also sell devices. The very best stuff that they get at gazelle.com, they will sell at a really good price. Everything they sell is in one of two conditions, either certified like new. Usually that means somebody bought something and sold it back to Gazelle or sold it to Gazelle because they just didn't want it. They never used it. And that's a smart thing to do. It's crazy just to throw those things in a drawer and let them get dust. That's cash. So that's the like new, but they also do something called certified good. These were devices, they're slightly worn. You know, little signs of wear. They're in great shape. In fact, Gazelle puts, they won't sell it if it's not 100% functional. They put every single device through their rigorous 30-point inspection. And, of course, you have a 30-day risk-free guarantee. You can return it anytime in those first 30 days, get your money back. So you're not taking a risk, but you are saving a lot of money. If your kids lose or break their devices, if you lose or break your devices, this is a great way to replace it. Gazelle, free shipping, fast processing, cash, PayPal credit, Amazon gift card when you sell your device to Gazelle, but you can also buy. Gazelle has paid out nearly $200 million to over 1 million customers, and I'm one of them. I've sold a lot of stuff on Gazelle, and I'm very happy they exist. GAZELLE.com. Get that 30-day quote right now. And if you're looking to replace your existing device, you might check it out there too. Gazelle.com. Back to Mac Break Weekly.
Thank you very much, Leo. So the new trailer for the new Steve Jobs movie is out. I've watched it several times. Maybe we could see a little bit of it just so that we're all on the same page for it.
What do you do? You're not an engineer. You're not a designer. You can't put a hammer to a nail.
Was never said.
I built the circuit board. The graphical interface was stolen.
I suspect there's a lot of things Steve.
10 times in a day, I read Steve Jobs as a genius.
Andy, why is the Green Hornet yelling at Magneto?
Musicians play their instruments.
I play the orchestra.
Clearly, you have not read the Secret Wars event in Marvel. You're from different segments of Battle World coming together for the first time.
You've been worse than usual this morning. I didn't think that was possible.
It's a system error.
Fix it.
Fix it?
Yeah.
We're not a pit crew at Daytona. This can't be fixed in seconds.
You didn't have seconds. You had 3 weeks.
I gotta say, I like
coming
up. The
universe was created in a third of that time.
Well, someday you'll have to tell us how you did it.
I liked it in the original movie.
I love that line in 1776. Yes.
Yes.
You see how this reminds you of a friendly face?
I'm surprised on that face it made the trailer.
Inviting, and yeah. It needs to say hello.
If you keep alienating people for no reason, there's going to be no one left for it to say hello.
I still don't get him as Waz, though.
$441 million. Well, you
I don't get the
and her mother are on
gun
welfare.
Pointing at his head. I don't.
Be able to. I love Aaron Sorkin so much, but this movie looks so not Steve Jobs to me.
Yeah,
I think it's a very poorly cut trailer, honestly. It's a very poorly cut trailer.
I love that scene, the scene with the glasses and the reflection of the devices. That
the angry feeling is driving Steve Jobs the entire trailer. It's just pushing that button, going, I'll show you, Apple!
Yeah. Well, the thing about trailers is that often it's cut together based on the footage they have available at that time. So that's why, especially in science fiction movies where you see stuff that doesn't it looks like crap with the first trailer because they only have like 8 seconds
the
of
viz,
special
yeah.
footage. Yeah. And it might be a similar thing going on here. That here is what's available. Here's what's been color timed. And here's what we're able to release right now.
The thing is, if you're looking at it, go ahead, Andy.
No, I'm going to say that it's going to be hard for me to evaluate this because I'm attracted to things like I don't remember Steve Jobs in his bow tie days ever combing his hair backward like that and having mousse in his hair. And I don't know whether that's a right, correct thing to be distracted by.
No. So I see this. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Ashley.
No, sorry. I too was totally distracted by that. I watched it several times, like I'm sure all of you. And one of the first things I thought is like, was looking like Steve Jobs a prereq for getting this role? Because I just didn't see it. Like I actually went back and looked up some of the pictures of Steve from those events. And I just couldn't see the connection at all. Like it looked like, Fassbender
looking
was sort
like
of like playing
you.
Himself in this role of Steve Jobs.
Because I was wondering, because we know Steve Jobs, anyone who watches this show or listens to the show knows Steve Jobs, has seen them all the keynote performances. He has such presence. He is such a performer that, for example, when I watched The Social Network, also written by Aaron Sorkin, I know Mark Zuckerberg's public persona, but I'm nowhere nearly as invested in it. And I don't know if I'd been covering Zuckerberg for years, I'd be going, no way, that's Zuckerberg. Yeah. So I wonder how much of us that is.
That's exactly right. It's sort of like being from Boston, and all you have to do is see a scene where you can't leave the public guard and go over a bridge and then be in Somerville. Come on, you people! It's like, but nobody outside of Boston would even care about that, and it's really not important to the movie. It really comes down to there's another movie coming out this summer, the Fantastic Four movie, where Michael Jordan is playing the Human Torch, and he does not look in any way like the Human Torch that's been depicted in the comic book for 40 years. But the thing
like
is,
Samuel Jackson is Nick Fury.
Exactly. But the thing is, you see him in the role and you forget all about it because your definition of the character warps around what the actor chooses to project if the actor is really, really good. So I'm not really worried about that. I'm just hoping that they get the tone right, that they don't come to, you know, Steve Jobs is this crying little baby, and Steve Wozniak is this cross-legged, just bouncy hippie who doesn't care about anything and doesn't. It's like you don't want them to turn into Lego minifigures, which is what the previous Steve Jobs movie did, I think.
But the Fantastic Four and S.H.I.E.L.D., those are fictional characters, and it feels like you can basically change that. Like, I had a conversation with Georgia last week where we were talking about you could have easily made Pippin and Merry female in the Lord of the Rings movies if you wanted more gender diversity, because they're fictional characters and you have license with those. But real people that we've seen, I don't know how much Morgan Freeman really looks like Nelson Mandela, or how much Gandhi really looks like Ben Kingsley, but because I've seen Steve Jobs so often, I just look at Michael Fassbender and I see Magneto.
So for me, this movie is not... I think that in order for Sorkin to write this movie, and I think in the order for this movie to exist, especially given the fact that Steve Jobs, you know, his life and death was so recent, yes, and the fact that we've already seen a really terrible movie version of his life... I don't think that this film is designed to be a biography. I mean, obviously it has biographical elements, but I really do feel like this is supposed to be the fictionally highlighted version of Steve. Not so the person on screen is not Steve Jobs, the man that you may have met at keynotes. It's this is the essence of Steve Jobs. If we were conscripted to write a movie about the essence of Steve and the
myth and legend,
well, not even the myth and legend, his I'm losing the word right now, but his essence, his being, you know, it's not necessarily about how he combed his hair. It's not necessarily about what he looks like on any given day. I think it's the rapport that you see between the people, the way that he interacts with technology, the way that he interacts with his company. There are little bits in that trailer that make me think they're shooting for painting an abstract painting rather than trying to do like pointillate specific images that will stand in your head. Like if you notice, almost like the trailer has hints of evocative images in it. Like you see the Welcome to Macintosh presentation, like in prep. You see Macs everywhere. You see the Lisa. You see him working with his daughter. But you never see
rain coming down behind him.
Yeah, but you never see photo. Like unlike the original, the previous Steve Jobs movie, there are no photos or there are no recreations of historic moments in this trailer. Like, this is obviously a historic moment, but you don't see the same shot, right? Yeah. They're showing sort of behind the scenes of that shot, but they're not actually being like, this is Steve. This is the presentation. This is the moment. I don't know. It feels more behind the scenes, less snapshot and more just general emotion evocativity.
Very Aaron
Sorkin. That even makes sense.
Yes. You've just defined a movie. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't pay $12 to go see a documentary of this nature. We want to understand more than reality can actually deliver to us. And I think that a good version of this will do that. So like we were joking about 1776 earlier, it's maybe 40% accurate as to how the Declaration of Independence was created and ratified. But the central truth of it, which was that it was a long, fraught out process with a lot of arguments, and everybody who finally ratified it understood that if this goes wrong, everybody in this room is absolutely going to be hanged. That's the central truth you can't get around, and that's what it delivers. So on that basis, mm-hmm. You understand that this is fiction, but you respect that at least it's honoring a central truth. So that's what we're hoping for with Steve Jobs.
My big question is that I saw the Imitation Game, and I knew that it wasn't factually like the exact story, but it was a great movie. I didn't care. Social Network, the same thing. I knew it wasn't the story of Facebook, like as was documented, but I didn't care. And I just worry that my own Apple investment will just keep intruding itself on my movie going experience here.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and that's a good question.
I think there's something to that though. Like with the Imitation Game or with the Social Network, like it wasn't called Facebook. It wasn't called like Mark Zuckerberg. Like this was called Steve Jobs. I think those details about his hair, the fact that we see hello on the Macintosh, the fact that we see the products in his glasses, we see the jeans and the black turtleneck as he's walking up to his daughter. The denial of his daughter and then, going back on that, like those details make it Steve Jobs. Like, I think it's a little disingenuous to try to say that, like, this is a movie that's based in fiction, but it's three major events that actually happened. And it's called Steve Jobs. Like, if you want to say that it's, I guess, a biography with that's loose and made for Hollywood, sure, but maybe this will only matter to super Appleheads, but it just feels a little, you got to go all the way because those details are things that like we love and we pay attention to and get us excited, you know?
Yeah. It'll come across when we see the actual movie. My opinion is that you are allowed to take certain dramatic license, as long as you're being really, really clear that this is not a documentary. Some of the stuff some of the stuff has happened. Some of the stuff didn't happen. Some of the people in this movie exist. Some of them we had to mush 8 different people together because we need someone representing this point of view that was not expressed by one person at this meeting.
An angry Woz.
Yeah, exactly. And the other problem that is certainly a difficulty is that a lot of people might see The Right Stuff, which is a 3-hour movie from 1980 about the Mercury space program, and think that that Gus Grissom freaked out when Liberty Bell 7 splashed down, pulled the emergency explosive bolts on the door because he was scared, and then caused the entire craft to sink. When that was that completely did not happen. It was a controversy for about 10 seconds until it was proven that no, he can possibly have done that deliberately. And now you want to make sure the people who are not terribly interested in this believe in the fiction over believing in the actual provable fact. So that is a risk.
Yeah. Well, so it's interesting to me because I actually recently saw one of Sorkin's recent plays, The Farnsworth Invention, last week. And in that, I don't know if anybody knows sort of the history behind that, but The Farnsworth Invention was a semi-fictional, semi-biographical story about a patent play between Farnsworth, who rightfully invented television, and the bigwigs at RCA. And the end of that play actually there's a patent trial, basically. And the end of the play awards the patent of the creation of television to RCA, when in fact, in reality, the patent was awarded to Farnsworth and not actually to RCA. But there was a big, long, drawn-out battle, and the result of which, even though Farnsworth won the patent, it was after like 15 years, and he'd become a drunk, and he basically, you know, died in an asylum. And so Sorkin took that event and condensed it into, well, I'm just going to say that RCA won because it has the same kind of desired effect without me having to show 15 years of patent trials on a stage. I feel like that's an interesting way to look at the way that Sorkin adapts material, especially biographical material, in that I don't think he's necessarily interested in capturing what's 100%, 110% true to life and what actually happened with a bullet point and an exclamation mark. I think he's more interested in telling the story and having the through line. And I don't necessarily know whether that makes for a good, whether it makes for a good story, whether it makes for good history. You know, there are people who might come and watch this movie who might not know much about Steve Jobs other than that guy who founded Apple. And maybe this movie will do a disservice to people who want to learn about Steve Jobs, or maybe it will capture the essence of who Steve Jobs is if those people want to learn more about him. I feel like it's really hard to judge based on the trailer. There are images in the trailer that I really like, though. I'm excited about the cinematography, if nothing else. Mm-hmm.
It's also a different viewership today than The Right Stuff had in 1980. 1980, again, let's say you're not terribly interested in the space program and you see this movie that fictionalizes the Mercury program. You might go home saying, oh, well, I guess, wow, too bad about Liberty Bell 7. I guess there's a reason why that guy was never trusted again. Yes, he was. He was on Apollo 1. He was so well trusted. But now if people come home after seeing the Steve Jobs movie, they can, while they're in the parking lot, they can get off their phones and Google information about Steve Jobs and get information about it. And there's certainly going to be people like us who are going to write about, here's, I was at that event, or I was around at that event. Here's what I recall that's different from this, and here's what they got right, and here's what they got wrong. So the movie doesn't have to carry the entire story to the extent that it had to, like in 1980.
It's got Bondi Blue all the way to the ground, much like ourselves. All right, so the big topic, the one that I've been saving for last, because I know Serenity at the very least has a lot to say about this, and I'm sure all of us do, but we've had about a week now to work on Apple Music and Beats 1 and explore it and learn about it and be told that it's filling up our catalogs with all sorts of nasty DRM. Is that correct, Ren?
Oh, boy. Well, no, it's not filling up your Mac with DRM. So the TLDR, the too long didn't read version of this, is essentially Apple Music is a music subscription service, which means that all of those tracks live in the cloud, where you can download them if you're a subscriber to any one of your devices and listen to them offline. Because if you had a subscription service where you couldn't actually bring your music with you, it would kind of stink. So you can download these files and bring them offline. But if you ever cancel your subscription, you don't get to keep them. That seems to make straightforward sense. No one's arguing over that. Most subscription services have DRM, which is just, you know, you either play it on one of the app, you know, Apple's devices, one of Google's apps, one of Amazon's apps, or you don't get to play the subscription service. Fine. That's not unusual. The tricky part here is that Apple Music also incorporates elements of Apple's iTunes Match service, which allows you to upload the library from your Mac or from any one of your Macs and store it alongside these subscription music files. So say I have four Taylor Swift songs from 1989. Those songs get put in my iCloud music library next to Taylor Swift's giant streaming catalog. Now, here's the super tricky part is that when you upload your music library to the iCloud music library to host it in iCloud music library, Apple only uploads tracks that it doesn't have in its catalog. So if it looks at your thing and is like, oh, you have a couple of Mac Bake Weekly recordings. I don't have this in my Apple Music streaming catalog. So I'm just going to upload these recordings as is, as iTunes song files, where they can be re-downloaded to another device as MP3s, however you uploaded them. But those Taylor Swift songs that I have, let's say I bought those off of Amazon, when it connects to the server, it says, oh, we have that album. We have 1989 on our Apple Music service. So we're going to match those tracks that you have locally on your device, on your Mac. We're going to match them in iCloud Music Library so that when you re-download them on another device, you're getting Apple Music's version of those tracks. Apple does this in part to save space and save you upload time, but also in part because you might have a track that's not quite as good quality. So they want to offer you really good quality when you're listening on other devices. However, because it's matching those songs with the Apple Music catalog, that means that any re-download or any download you do to an auxiliary device will have the Apple Music DRM on it. And that's where people are getting into a tizzy, because iTunes Match does not have DRM. iTunes Match does the same thing, that uploading and matching service to allow you to have your songs on any one of your devices. But when you re-download, it's actually linking to the iTunes Store catalog rather than the Apple Music catalog. So when you re-download, you're getting a DRM-free track from the iTunes Store if that track is matched. With Apple Music, you're downloading from the streaming catalog. So you're getting a DRM streaming song. So the people who are really running into issues here, the reason why this became such a big deal is that when iTunes Match came out, people quickly kind of realized that you can upload your Mac's music library to iTunes Match, delete your low quality files that you may have ripped off of CDs 10 years ago or gotten off of Napster, and re-download them from the iTunes Store. And hey, now I have high quality tracks on my Mac. Or I don't need to store all of these files on my Mac. I can just store it in iCloud and it's no problem. And they delete their entire Mac music library and just rely on iCloud. And that, A, is a really dumb idea. You need a backup. I'm sorry. You can't rely on the cloud. But B, it's getting these people into trouble because they, you know, they sign up for Apple Music and they may still be Match subscribers. But when they sign up for Apple Music, there's a bug right now where if you're an iTunes Music if you're an Apple Music and an iTunes Match subscriber, occasionally when you look at an auxiliary device or if you look at your main Mac and you have songs that you've deleted, it might show up as Apple Music, as an Apple Music track rather than an iTunes Match track connected to the iTunes Store catalog. And that's gotten people up in a tizzy. Oh no, Apple's putting DRM on my Mac. How dare they? And the answer is no, Apple is not DRMing songs you already own and have downloaded. It's if you are subscribed to Apple Music, it's trying to match them with the streaming catalog, which happens to have DRM. It's not unusual. The issue is that Apple did not publicize this in any way. When they were talking about the differences between iTunes Match and Apple Music, it was, they're complementary. How they're complementary, we're not going to tell you. They're essentially the same service, except one has DRM-free and one has DRM. And Apple was very hush-hush about this, in part because I think they just don't want to talk about DRM. So that is the slightly long but very convoluted but valid thing about why people are mad right now.
I think I'm really appreciative that you actually took the time to figure this out, because like you said, no one provided this information. This was a result of you spending a couple of days hammering at it and figuring out what happened. But it is super complicated, because you can have stuff that you acquired from outside of iTunes, stuff you acquired on iTunes, stuff that is iTunes Match, stuff that is from Apple Music, stuff that you've downloaded locally, stuff that you're streaming. And that's an incredible level of complexity. And if it takes tech journalists days to figure this stuff out, I can't even imagine what just a person trying to listen to their music has to go through.
Yeah, and that concerns me a lot. I will say that the majority of people, at least the major complaints that I've been seeing about Apple Music and about DRM and all of that, it's largely techies who have Match and who have done crazy things like deleted their entire library off one computer. I feel like the vast majority of users, this isn't going to, like, they're not going to notice it, because, again, Apple wants to wash it. You know, Apple wants to do everything for you. It all happens behind the curtain. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. The average user probably has their iTunes Music library locally on their Mac, on their one Mac. And then when they turn on Apple Music, oh, hey, all of a sudden they have all of that music on their iPhone and their iPad too. That's really cool. And then if they cancel their Apple Music subscription, oh, that music went away on my iPhone and my iPad. Well, I guess that makes sense, because I don't have the subscription anymore. Like I feel like the average user would never have subscribed to iTunes Match. Like, iTunes Match subscriptions, I think, are still fairly small in the grand scheme of things. The average user, you know, doesn't really, like, they care about DRM when we publicize it and we're like, DRM, 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 be scared for your files. And in fact, there were a couple people who wrote very inflammatory articles that were very much like, oh, Apple is labeling all of your songs with DRM, like not actually bothering to look into looking into what was actually going on. They just heard the DRM word, like the D word, and was like, we've got to let everybody know that all of your music is doomed. And it's,
so doomed.
No, yeah. No. Right. I mean, it's still frustrating, but.
Thank you for your piece, Serene. It clearly explained things that I didn't know I had questions about, especially iTunes Match. I never knew what iTunes Match actually was for. So if nothing else, I thought you really articulated those points very clearly. And,
I'm glad.
You know, technology in general, especially Apple's supposed to be one of the platforms that's seamless, right? That sort of just makes sense and is intuitive and understandable. And, you know, I just got back from visiting my parents and family, and nobody still knows how to use these things. My mom just recently bought a paper calendar because she doesn't know how to. She has an iPhone 6 Plus. She has no idea how to use calendar app on her phone. And, you know, it scares me that the more conveniences we make and the more abstractions we create, it's still a confusing proposition to try to bring people on board and to
My
bring
mom
the average
went to the
person
Apple Store and took a free course just to learn how to use the calendar. So, I mean, that kind of stuff is an option, but it's kind of crazy that kind of stuff is an option.
Yeah, absolutely.
I had an experience over the weekend. I knew that before upgrading to the desktop version of the new iTunes with Apple Music, I wanted to make sure that I had a backup of all of my local files. I had read Serenity's piece, but it's always there's no question to which the answer, what if I make another backup just in case, is the wrong answer. It's nothing bad will happen because you made a superfluous backup of all your data. And that's when I found out for the first time since October, my actual music library is not on my hard drive. It is all iTunes Match, because for reasons that would be way too long to explain, I ran out of space on the SSD inside my new MacBook and decided I'm going to basically plug in an external SSD that would handle all my libraries, all my music and photo libraries. And I'm not incapable of doing stupid things, but I'm probably not really dumb when it comes to this stuff. And I was absolutely certain that I'd copy the entire library off of the internal drive and onto the external drive and set that as the new library. Turns out that didn't happen at all. I didn't discover that until I explicitly tried to go and look to see where are my music files and why is this folder not as big as I expected it to be. And so had I gone onward and just simply clicked the button that all Apple's ads is telling me to do, new iTunes music, I could have got myself in really big trouble. It would have been very stupid to deliberately say I'm going to delete all my music off of my hard drive, but I managed to do so without knowing that I had done so. I don't know how many people are actually using iTunes Match, but remember that this wasn't this little thing feature that you would find if you looked in the right tech note. This was something that Apple was promoting as, here's another reason why you don't need to have, we can still sell the iPhone with 1.2 gigabytes of storage because you don't store anything on a phone, you silly goose. You're going to put it all in the cloud. Don't worry about it. We're doing all the thinking for you. So there's a great complexity to all of this sort of stuff that we're often immune to and ignorant of. And if it's there's no excuse for saying that Apple applied DRM to all my music files without actually, you know, it's labor intensive if you're a journalist, but you can figure these things out. All you have to do is be somebody who cares about your job like Serenity does, and you can actually do this stuff. But nonetheless, I don't, and I'm really, really concerned about people who assume that everything just works and everything that they think is true is actually true. And I don't know that there's a really good solution to that, but all I know is that I'm really, really glad that I have another backup somewhere the last backup I did of this machine before I tinkered with it. And that now I have another hard drive so I can, before I upgrade to the new Apple Music, I can just do iTunes Match and simply say, download everything you got from the cloud and put it into this new volume and then unplug it and put it in a damn drawer where iTunes and Apple Cloud services can never find it. The last thing is, maybe it's good to have a poll of the panel. Is there anybody who just implicitly trusts that if Apple has a cloud service that it will work great? Do you trust it?
I trust
Dropbox. I
trust but verify. Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, right? I have gotten closer to trusting Apple, which is to say that I have my photos in iCloud Photo Library, which is something that I was never comfortable really doing with iCloud sharing or anything like that. And I actually have all of them in the Photos app on OS X, and that actually feels okay. And I've been using Match since it premiered in 2011, and I have, by and large, I guess, one of the few people who've had no problems with Match. Match has worked perfectly for me. But I have a library that's under 25,000 songs. I don't have any crazy classical music tracks, and I haven't tried to do anything too zany with it. I have all of my tracks on my iMac, and then I have all of my tracks in the cloud for my MacBook Air, and then maybe like one or two albums stored locally. So I feel like I trust Apple's cloud services to a certain extent. I don't trust that they will be perfect. I know that there are bugs. I know that there are workarounds that I'm going to have to deal with. But I also trust that they are committed to making it better. Because I've been a member of, you know, iCloud back when it was called iTools in like the early 2000s, late 90s. I don't even remember when iCloud or when iTools premiered. But, you know, I've been with the Mac Cloud machine for a very long time. And I've seen how much it's improved. So I'm reluctant to say that I don't trust it, because I do. I use a lot of Apple services, and I use them with varying degrees of success, mostly. I mean, like 97% success rate on Apple's cloud services. But I know that I am more likely an exception to the rule than the actual rule, because I know a lot of people who do have problems with Apple's cloud services.
I trust but verify. I have everything in the cloud, on the local, then backed up on Time Machine and often Super Duper as well. So I'm one of those. Sorry, Ashley.
Yeah, I think from a security... No, sorry. I think from a security perspective, more or less trust Apple as any syncing cloud service, which means with great trepidation. But it's hard to I guess, have confidence in the reliability of the syncing when, like, I open notes and I have duplicates of all my notes and I know, or reminders. And I know that those are probably, like, low priority products for Apple, given sort of them being in the hardware business and those being free apps. But as a consumer, it's hard not to, like, put or see them all as sort of, like, cloud syncing services. And so it's like, if you can't get this right, how are you going to get this other thing right?
Yeah, I had a bug where it was duplicating all my notes and I left iCloud note syncing on, turned off Google note syncing, and it appeared to start working. But that kind of stuff is also non-intuitive to sort of figure out. On the same bent, there was a post from Dave Wiskus, who I think is at least a friend of many of ours on this panel. And he is a musician as well as an iOS app designer. And his band Airplane Mode wanted to try the new Kinect features, and they wanted to share some music they were experimenting with. And he detailed the process of trying to do that through the music app. Apple has released a GarageBand update on iOS that has sort of Kinect sharing built in, and they're going to update the OS X version of that. But Dave, trying to do it through the music app, he had a lot of problems, including having to add a space to be able to edit something and not being sure what was permanent, what wasn't permanent. To Apple's credit, Trent Reznor saw the post and replied to him within a day, which is I think really responsive compared to the traditional Apple approach. And Eddie Q has been Twittering a lot, I think more in the last couple of weeks than he has in the last couple of years, maybe, saying, for example, home sharing would be coming back in iOS 9. But Andy, is this sort of to be expected when a new product launches? Should they be held to a higher standard? Are they being responsive? Is being responsive good, or should they not need to be this responsive?
I think if my mother had a cloud service, I wouldn't trust it immediately. I would ask her a lot of questions about where things store, and I would still do a backup before flipping that switch. That said, I seem to have a lot of problems with Apple's cloud services that I don't have with other services. Microsoft's OneDrive has been really, really rock solid and reliable for me. As I said about Dropbox, every time that I trust it to do something, it does exactly what I expected, what I asked it to do, what I trusted it to do, and it didn't screw anything up on me. And I think the difference between those two is that Apple is very, the strength, all of the things they do that's great, and many of the things that they do that is not, doesn't turn out great, is a result of saying to the user, don't worry about it. We got this. Nope, you don't have to understand anything. Just flip the switch. We will handle everything. And maybe part of that responsibility is on us as users, because, you know, it's possible to simply say, don't even bother lifting the hood of your car. You never need to know anything about how this car works. Yeah, but if you understand that there are belts that drive things and hoses that deliver fluids from one place to another, and there's this thing called an alternator that keeps generating electricity, you will be able to spot problems on your own and prevent yourself from being stranded in the middle of nowhere with no cell service at 2 a.m. someplace. So maybe there's some blame to be spread around, but I do think that Apple has to build trust with the larger community with their cloud services at this point. But to answer your question, you know, nothing on week one is going to be perfect.
And it's interesting because iTunes 12.2 did land, and there was some sort of hope that maybe Apple would do something different, that maybe we would get a bigger update. I think 12.2 being circulated widely before the update sort of lessened those hopes. But some people were hoping maybe for a separate music app like iOS. And some people were maybe hoping that there would be a redesign that made all this stuff simpler. But iTunes still has to be ported to Windows. It still has to sync all those legacy iPod devices. Some people still use it for modern iOS devices as well. It's got so many conflicting masters. And when it did land, it sort of had music added on top of everything else. And I know, Srinity, you did a post today trying to help people find out how to turn iTunes Match back on or turned on for the first time in an Apple Music world. Peter Cohen, who we work with, wrote sort of a screed about the state of iTunes now. How are you finding it?
Oh, gosh. You know, iTunes is better than it was. I like iTunes 12.2 better than its predecessor, but it's still buggy. There is somebody on Twitter, I forget whom, who was speculating that perhaps this was a last minute rushed release of just a iTunes tack on, and they had originally planned to release an all new music app, but just didn't have the time. And I would agree with that. Yeah. I would definitely agree with that, because iTunes has been big and bloated and buggy for a long time, but it feels especially bloated right now with the radio and the music tabs. It doesn't quite work the way that the music app on iOS works. Certain things are majorly buggy. Playlists, for example, you can't, like, adding playlists just doesn't work on the Mac. Like, adding certain songs just doesn't work. The fact that you can't listen to Beats 1 via AirPlay on OS 10, but you can on iOS. There are a lot of, like, really weird, strange bugs. New icon, that's nice. I really expect this to be called Music when El Capitan comes out in the fall, and I expect it to be a redesigned program.
It's interesting, actually. Peter noticed that, you know, there is For You and My Music. There's Radio and and Beats Radio. There's a new and recently added. There seems to be, just from a basic UX point of view, a lot of things that aren't duplicative but might seem that way, or aren't, or should be complementary but seem more confusing right now. I lost everybody with that.
We all paused.
I thought they were asking Ashley.
Sorry, were you asking me?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah.
No, I agree. It's definitely a little bit of a confusing interface. I did think setting up the music app, though, was kind of cool with the bubbles. And you can sort of tap a bubble to uncover, or I guess selecting sort of like what music you prefer and what Apple should start recommending you and in what genres. I thought that process was kind of cool. But the rest of it, like you said, is a little bit confusing. It's like, oh, there's my Beats 1 radio station, but then also I can have radio stations cater to a specific artist. I thought one of the cooler things, though, was the fact that I think music's a little bit easier to access. So purchased music, if it's not already downloaded on your phone, it's kind of like seamlessly shown, which maybe some people wouldn't like, but I thought it was kind of cool that it was sort of seamlessly shown with music that's also already downloaded. And then you could choose to sort of make it offline or not, but all of the music was available to you to stream. I don't know what that's going to do to people's data, to people's data on their cellular plans, but I thought it made it a little bit easier to surface that, because typically it's like it was buried in like several menus to get to music that you hadn't already put on your device but was purchased.
You weren't here last week, so what do you think in general about Apple Music and Beats? So always on, 24/7, breaking worldwide. Have you tried it? Are you enjoying it?
I used to love the radio, and so I think that's probably the most exciting thing. It's been funny to watch people sort of listen to the radio communally on Twitter and then talk about what they're listening to at the same time. Beyond that, no, it's more, I guess we'll see over time. Right now it feels like a fun gimmick that's sort of pulling people in.
What about you, Ren? How's Apple Music a week later?
I'm really enjoying it. I love Beats 1. I listened to Elton John's Rocket Hour this morning, which is now in a three-way tie for my favorite segmented show with St. Vincent's and with The Alligator Hour with Josh Homme. It's really fun. I am really digging the Siri integration and just being able to be like, Siri, play more like this. Siri, add this to my music library. Siri, play the top song. Siri, play Motion City soundtrack. Like that, it's so much easier to navigate in the car. And I want to write a piece about this at some point. But just in-car navigation has, especially for streaming music, has been improved a millionfold with the integration of Siri into Apple Music. It's just awesome.
That's so I'm really digging it.
Yeah. I'm really digging it aside from the crazy match issues. But I'm not happy. Like, again, this is something I've kind of had to dig through and try and recreate, because I'm not actually having any of the match music issues. All of my tracks show up as matched.
The Siri thing is interesting, though. We had some people complaining that in order to use Siri to do things like add more of this or play after this, you have to actually interrupt what you're doing right now. So you're loving the music you're listening to, but to get more of it, you have to momentarily stop it, talk to Siri, and then let it keep going instead of... I don't know what else Apple could do for that situation, but it does seem interesting.
So, you know, I actually kind of hope that they end up doing what they do for the watch, which is that, you know, if you have music playing on your phone, you can still use Siri on your watch and it actually doesn't interrupt the music on your phone. I think it would be really cool when Siri is triggered, if you have music playing, to just dim it, so that obviously, like, if it's coming out of the same speakers that your microphone is coming out of, maybe you need to, you know, just cut it entirely. Maybe that's necessary for the microphone to properly pick up what you're saying. But if they're going through external speakers, it would be really cool to just dim it and just let Siri listen to your voice.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And the commands that they have added, the ability to integrate with Apple Music, when you can just say things like add this to my up next queue or find me more artists like this, I think Siri is the only way you can actually shuffle everything that you're listening to right now. It has become super powerful, and it's one more argument for Siri becoming that sort of adjacent interface. And I know you've spoken about this before, Andy, but and Amazon is doing this with Echo, but the idea for having this on a Apple TV update or more pervasively throughout Apple's ecosystem gets even more interesting when it's got cloud integration like this.
Yeah, and I actually think the killer app for this is just the ability to have an absolute always-on microphone. I would spend, after my experience with Amazon Echo last week, I've been sort of spending alternating evenings listening to Apple Music and listening to my Amazon library through my iPhone and then through Amazon Echo. And I really very much preferred using the Echo because I'm just sitting on the sofa. I've got a book in my lap or I got the laptop in my lap. The ability to simply call out a playlist and it goes and just simply lift up my head marginally and then say, Alexa, next. Because there's a 7-minute long thing that I'm really not into. It's a different thing when you have to reach to the coffee table, pick up your phone, and then say, hey, Shlomo, next. Or you have to raise something up to your wrist up to your face and give a command. If Apple were to come out with just a Bluetooth speaker with a really good omnidirectional microphone that has direction awareness and the ability to not have to mute music in order to accept a command, that would so totally enhance Siri 100 times, particularly when it comes to listening to music. As you know, even though this is a playlist you put together yourself, you're just not you forgot that this is the one where Tony Bennett starts off by introducing all the members of the band before getting to the song, and you're just not in a mood to hear 2 minutes of, and now my pianist for over 14 years, Mr. Elton. Like, okay, thank you very much. You want to go to the next track now? So I've been having a good time with Apple Music. I have to say that I'm a little more eager to see advances in the apps than in the content. I'm more eager than ever to see Apple just break iTunes app or the music app into several pieces now and have one app on macOS that is just for iOS syncing, one app that is just for music devices, and just make sure you have it. Instead of having this tabbed experience that is getting more and more like Microsoft Office every single day. And oh my God, I'm supposed to be listening to and enjoying music, not thinking about a multi-plane spreadsheet every time I want to access my albums. I do think that's time for them to make a special interface for each thing they're going to do and break those up into separate apps now.
A friend of the show, Adam Angst, was asking about, he said he likes Beats Radio overall, but every once in a while, a song comes up that he just can't stand, doesn't want to listen to. And he would like either a command that says mute and then start playing again as soon as that song's over, or some way for it to play another song that's of similar length and then notify him or automatically go back to Beats Radio.
Yeah. Maybe a Sandman Sims option where just you hear this music strike up. And then the sound of like a clown coming up on the stage with a big broom and just swatting Elton John or whatever on the behind. So that's exactly it. I think that Beats 1 is a much better station than I thought it was going to be. It's because it's so eclectic. But yeah, it's like I would much rather listen to nothing than listen to the rest of this song.
Senator, do we need a Beats 2 for classical, Beats 3 for country? Does this thing scale?
You know, I do think it's interesting that it's called Beats One, a la BBC One, BBC Radio One. I think that eventually we might see a splinter, like assuming that this is successful and assuming they can figure out a way to make money off of it other than just having these little sponsorships or that assuming that Apple Music is paying for it. I think we might see a radio like sub genres. But I'm not necessarily sure if it'll be off of the main 24/7 station or whether they'll just be regular recurring programs. I am sad that we haven't seen a classical program. We've seen most of the modern music of this era, but we haven't really seen a lot of blues. We haven't seen a lot of jazz. We haven't seen any true classical. We haven't seen any musicals. So it would be interesting to get that. Although I will say that Zane Lowe played a a track from a really obscure Broadway musical. The track was called Zombie, and it was very, very bizarre and awesome and totally unexpected. I was listening to one of his playlists after the show had already aired, and that was the last song. And I was just like, what is this? What have I just listened to? And I'm like, oh, it's a Broadway musical. Okay, that makes sense. So they are like integrating some stuff into their shows. It's just, I would love to hear some, like an hour dedicated to classical music.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a first things first sort of attitude, especially when you're telling it what your musical tastes are with those bubbles at the beginning, because most, I would say half of or to even three quarters of my music is classical and opera and Broadway and jazz. And it really is like going to the mall store where, oh, classical, right, we got four of those CDs. We've got Placido Domingo, and we've got Hooked on Classics, and then I can't remember, then we're out of stock on the other two. I just remember after going through, like, pushing all the bubbles, there is such fine, when I push the bubble for, I like alt rock, a million bubbles pop up to be specific. Say, well, no, I do like classical. Do you like Leonard Bernstein? Sure. Okay, do you like, we got nothing. And the recommendations that it's making for the stuff are also not fine grained. I bet that within 6 or 7 months, it's going to come up with better suggestions for people who are not necessarily at the middle of musical tastes.
To go back to the Apple TV prognostication stuff before, there was the Apple TV is still being developed now. They have not released Apple Music for the Apple TV yet. That is still a pending update. But they did release Showtime online. So if you are in the US of A, you can subscribe to Showtime. I think it's $10 or $11. And that goes along with things like HBO Now, which is a similar subscription service. Sonnity, is there any appeal to you for Showtime versus HBO versus the traditional ways of getting this stuff?
HBO is only appealing to me right now because I watch certain shows that are on HBO. Showtime, I assume, would be appealing to me if I was watching Showtime shows. Currently, I'm not. But yeah, I would much rather subscribe on a per channel basis than subscribe to a bulk thing. Because the beauty of these one-off subscription programs is that, unlike, you know, if I subscribe to Charter or Comcast or Fios or any of those, I'm committing to like a year-long or two-year-long commitment of like God knows how many channels and all of this, you know, all of this on my television and a big giant box. Whereas with these one-offs, I want to watch Game of Thrones for 3 months. Okay, I subscribe to HBO Now for 3 months and then I end my subscription. I end my Hulu subscription. I start my Showtime subscription. I end my Showtime subscription. It's as easy as that. And so if I don't, you know, I'm not paying for 12 months something that I am really only watching for two or three. And I like that. I think it's a nice option. It might be more a la carte than it is as a bundle in the long term. But if you're paying this sort of month to month, I feel like it's the better option.
Yeah, that's my concern, because if you're paying $10 for HBO, $10 for Netflix, $10 for Showtime, and especially Showtime and HBO, that's $20 just for two channels. And I know Videotron here in Quebec is an exception, but we were paying $20 for 20 channels a la carte and $30 for 30 channels off a la carte. And I'm sure it's more expensive now, but that was years ago. But Andy, I don't know how well this model scales. If you start wanting 10 channels, is that $100 plus other subscriptions? Or is that where the much rumored Apple service sort of comes into play?
Yeah, that is difficult. It's hard to tell somebody that, here are your two options. You can either buy HBO and Showtime a la carte as these apps and pay about $15 a month, or you can get it through your cable provider and pay roughly the same amount of money per month. If you buy it a la carte, you can get it through you can get it on your iPad with any sort of app, which I agree that you can also download the HBO app. And if you just log in with your subscriber information, trust us, it's going to be awesome. But I think it's the win of it is more along the lines of what Serenity was talking about, that there are a lot of people who either A, don't want to have that sort of commitment to subscribing to something month after month after month when they really just want it for a few months just to watch this one series, or they're not, they don't own the cable box in the house where they live, so they want to basically have their own HBO that they can take with them wherever they go. It's been what, 3 years since the Steve Jobs book claimed that Steve Jobs has, quote, solved, unquote, finally the problem of television. And I still have no idea what they're referring to. My dream would be a service where it's just a random indiscriminate box. I can buy whatever combination of channels I want. My fantasy is not the ability to buy Showtime a la carte. It's the ability to get Turner Classic Movies or BBC America. Or, again, I'm paying for 400 channels because there are six that I actually like. And Sling TV is getting better. As a matter of fact, Sling TV just got Turner Classic Movies, but even they're starting to like package things. And I keep hitting my head against that exact same wall saying, so I'm going to cancel my cable subscription package for these channels so that I can then pay roughly the same amount of money for a la carte access to these channels. And I will not be able to get access to that 2 times a year when I'm actually there's women's World Cup soccer, and I can actually see the preliminary games on this really obscure sports channel. I need to be able to get access to that like once every 4 years. So it's a hard sell, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels like Jobs' last theorem, where like he's just scribbled in the margins of the Walter Isaacson's biography. I cracked this, and we'll just never know what it is.
Maybe that was like on his plans for the last week. Say, after they call in a different like reporter and say, and also, faster than light travel colonizing Mars. We finally cracked it. I'll tell you all about it next month.
Oh, so wrong.
The great tease.
So the last thing I wanted to talk about before we get to picks of the week is an article by Ben Beharin, who's a very well-known Apple analyst, and he was one of the people who did an early review on the Apple Watch. And over the last couple of weeks, he decided to spend some time without it. But because he's Ben Beharin and because he's an analyst, he didn't just take it off and then share his feelings about it. He actually recorded data to show what his behavior was like when he was wearing it and then what his behavior was like when he stopped wearing it. One of the hard things about the Apple Watch is that with a lot of Apple products, it's about how immersive the experience is. It's how much time you spend watching Apple TV or playing games or reading stuff on your iPad or communicating on your iPhone. It's how much you're involved and ensconced in it. But with the Apple Watch, it's sort of like how much time can we save you? And that's a harder metric to measure because it's sort of a disengagement metric. But Ben, to his credit, documented it, and he was showing how many times, for example, he reached for his iPhone when he had his Apple Watch versus not having his Apple Watch. Serenity, I don't know about you. I went a weekend just to try without an Apple Watch to see what it would feel like, and I never realized before. I just would see empty wrist, and that was a clue that how often I was just used to glancing at my Apple Watch before without even realizing it.
Absolutely. I feel exactly the same way. I have been taking this off. I've been moving recently. And even though Apple shows you moving with Apple Watches and, using it as a way to get your activity points in, I've been taking it off because we've been going through tight doorways and I don't want to bang it everywhere. And every time I take it off for a short period of time, it's like, where'd you go? And I've become much more aware of where my phone is at all times. Whereas with the watch, I feel much more comfortable leaving my phone. Like there are times when I don't know where my phone is in the house. And actually I had a stress dream of all things. I had a stress dream last night where I was in a movie theater and I had walked out with my iPhone and I was using my Apple Watch to try and figure out where in the movie theater my iPhone was because it would go in between showing the connected at the top and the disconnected. Like this is how weird this product is that it has infiltrated my stress dreams about not knowing where my iPhone is. But yeah, I really like the watch. I think that it's not, I'm not talking about it nonstop as much as I used to, but I still think it's a very vital part of my day-to-day beings. And it's gone into a very much more subtle pattern than it used to be.
Ben called it a modern day convenience, Andy, almost like a dishwasher where, yeah, you can wash your own dishes, but once you get used to having a dishwasher, it's just so convenient. You really don't want to go back.
Yeah, I think he's I can't speak for him. I wonder if what he's saying is true of smartwatches in general. because I'm still now on week five, week six, because now I'm editing what was originally 9,000 words on Apple Watch that's being split up into different pieces. And only when I was preparing to give a talk on a different subject that I actually sat down and thought, okay, how many different apps on this watch are you actually using regularly? And I could not mention I could not think of a single one of them that is not a built-in watch app. All the stuff that I like about it are the stuff that I like about smartwatches in general, being able to get notifications on your wrist, having a fitness tracker built in, having something sort of cooler than just your regular analog watch on your wrist. And I'm still kind of more hurting for the lack of Android Wear than for Apple Watch. But I think that's logical and reasonable because the watch that I was wearing for 8 or 9 months like that had 6 or 7 or 8 months worth of tweaks and improvements and upgrades on it. I really think that's, as we've been saying for the past month, it's going to be a game changer when Watch OS 2 comes out in the fall. That's when we're really going to, that's when I think the watch really launches, and that's when I'm going to have to go back and reevaluate because I did, as a matter of fact, take off my watch for, I didn't actually take it off though. The battery ran down. And then I had the charger someplace that's not on my nightstand. And so I sort of forgot about it and wound up wearing my old analog watch for 2 or 3 days. And to be honest, I really didn't miss it. It's a nice convenience, but it's not the sort of thing where I feel, oh, my God, I got to drive back to the house because I'm not wearing my Apple Watch. But different strokes, different groups.
You didn't get the addictive version, Andy, the one with a little subcutaneous implant that keeps you.
Well, see, that's why I put the gaffer tape on the bottom of the sensor there. You know, just to, you know, again, trust but verify.
Actually, you and I were at a bunch of the sessions at WWDC, and what Andy's talking about, the WatchOS 2.0 stuff looks super interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very intrigued to see what apps are going to come as a result of being able to run natively on the watch now. It's funny, I felt myself installing apps just because they had Apple Watch support, you know, even apps I previously deleted. And now I've noticed that I've tend to keep using just the activity tracker, heart rate monitoring, and, you know, pausing and playing music or podcasts. I feel like my use of the different kinds of apps has almost like regressed a little bit. And so I'm intrigued to see if WatchOS 2 is going to sort of like pull me back in or get me interested in using different types of apps or not. Primarily, I just use it for the notifications. I certainly miss it when I'm exercising. There was one time I left it at work for the weekend, and I really wished I had it with me when I went out and played football with some of my friends. But that's about it. You know, for social engagements or the trip I took over the weekend, I didn't bring my Apple Watch with me. So, but I do notice that I miss having a watch. Like, I have a watch 10 now. There has to be something on my wrist. If it's not the Apple Watch, it's got to be an analog watch.
Just hearing you say that puts me in Serenity Stress Dream. That's what I have on now.
What'd you say?
Just hearing you say that puts me in Serenity Stress Dream. All right. So we're in the fine tradition of Mac Break Weekly. We are going to do our picks of the week. And we're going to start with the inimitable Andy Anatko. What do you have for us this week, Andy?
Mine is, I picked this without knowing what we were going to be talking about. It's just a complete accident. Mine is the knee band. Which is the TLDR on this one is that it is a cheap ass fitness band. It is made in China and you can buy it. I don't think that there's a distributor for it in the United States, but if you go to Amazon, you can pay all of 12 or 13 stinking dollars for it. And in 2 to 3 weeks, one will be shipped to you from Asia. And the weird thing is about it that I'm sort of been on this jag over the past year and a half of looking for really stupid, cheap versions of different pieces of technology to see how well or how poorly they perform. And this performs really, really well. It's only about as feature rich as an entry level fitness band. So it has motion so it can count your steps. It will count your movement when you're and figure out how you're sleeping. It also has a feedback device on it, so it will buzz when your phone rings. You can twist it and lights will show up to show you how close you are to your step goal. And it has a actually very, very nice, nicely done iOS app. That will let you get access to all that information. And so is it great? It's not superb. I mean, it's not cheaply made. I mean, there is nothing about this band that seems cheap. It's made out of the same grade of polymer. It's a grade of polymer that was made specifically for use in fitness trackers. So it's not cheap. It doesn't break or anything like that on you. The battery lasts pretty much forever. I charged it up when I bought it 2 months ago, and I just checked this morning, and the battery is still at about 50%. I did have it off for about a week or two during that because I was testing other fitness bands. But the great thing about it, though, is that it's like I was talking about earlier, the idea of wearing a fitness monitor to at least keep you appraised of here's how much you're moving every single day, or more to the point, here's how much you're not moving every single day. Here's how much sleep you're getting every night, or more to the point, here's how much sleep you're not getting every night. There are a couple of different barriers to people getting the benefits of wearing a fitness tracker. One of them is that they can't see spending $60 or $70 for this when they don't know if it's going to be usable. And secondly, they don't necessarily want to take this off their wrist every single night and pop it into a charger, or even do that once a week. With this one, you can actually just keep it on all the time. It has the IP rating so that you can actually shower with it. You can swim with it. It'll work just fine. And so if it's a cheap way to enter into this sort of awareness, and then it leads to you 6 or 7 months later wanting to buy an Apple Watch or wanting to buy a better fitness band, I think that's all to the good. People, a lot of people can risk $12 that they can't even risk $70 or $80. There are only two other qualms that I'll give about it in that the app is very, very good. Its integration to health works. So you can go into the health dashboard and allow this app to feed information into the health app. I've been reading for the past 2 or 3 weeks people who test these things a lot rigorously than I know how to do. And they're reporting that it's a lot of the data that comes in is a little bit off or not necessarily great. And so for now, my recommendation before I check this out myself is it's okay if you don't plug this, if you don't connect, hook this up to the health app, you just use the built-in apps, which are very, very nice and very, very easy to use. The second thing is that when you launch the app, you pair it with your phone. You have to run this free app that you get off the iTunes store. And the first thing it will do to, by default, it will ask you to use a phone number as your ID so it can sync data to the wonderful world of me servers in the world. You don't have to do that. I couldn't find a way around it when I first downloaded this app 2 months ago. What I did, because my instinctive reaction is, why the hell do you think you need my phone number just to be able to sync data between the phone and the device? If you go to the me.com site, you can actually create an account on the site and it doesn't require a phone number. You can just use whatever made up name, whatever burner email address you want to use, and then plug that in and it'll work just fine. But like I said, very nice recommendation. You definitely have to accept that this is a $13 thing and not a $200 thing. But again, if it gets you to get access to that information to tell you that, wow, I'm only sleeping 4 hours a night, or wow, I had two whole days in a row where I walked fewer than 2,000 steps, that's a really pretty big win for not a whole lot of money.
If you want to dip your toe into the whole quantified life thing, but you don't want to dive full into the deep end of the watch pool, you can
exactly
check this out. Ashley, do you have something for us?
I do. I have this article from, I guess Essence got the exclusive Essence magazine, but over the weekend, Ava DuVernay, the director of Selma, announced that she would not be directing the Black Panther movie, which I thought, I just found really interesting because, you know, lately we've been talking about, or in the public discourse, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, but this idea of having superheroes that, you know, represent the full spectrum of people and aren't, you know, stereotypically of one character type. And so, you know, Marvel ostensibly wants to produce this movie called Black Panther, which would have a black male lead. And Ava DuVernay was up for the directorship. And I just found it really interesting that, you know, a position that she could have had as the director of a big budget film possibly would have done great things for her career, or maybe not. But she decided not to take the position because of creative differences. And I just thought that was really incredible because it could have been very easy for her as a black woman to take on the role of directing one of the first major black superhero films. And for her to decide that it wasn't for her, based on, again, creative differences, I just thought was really incredible. And she just continues to impress me and sort of like the decisions she makes as a director and sort of what films she and roles she takes on. And I'm interested to see how this project will go moving forward. They have Chadwick Boseman, who's supposed to play the title character, and he also played Jackie Robinson and James Brown recently. So we'll see how that goes. But either way, it'll be moving forward without Ava DuVernay.
It's interesting because Marvel seems to be running these movies not like a typical movie studio where you have just a director who's in charge of the movie, but more like a TV show where you have a showrunner who then gets directors, and the directors are way less important than the overall story being told by the show. And directors like her, and you hear that a little bit now with Joss Whedon, and you've heard that with, I'm blanking on his name, but the original Ant-Man director, who basically want to do more of a traditional movie relationship. And it's interesting. I think it's absolutely interesting what you said, but I think it's also interesting for the sort of different voices we get in the Marvel universe and whether that will be suppressed compared to the overall Marvel vision.
Yeah, that's a good point about Marvel's vision and sort of they're like directing by committee almost. At least that's how Joss Whedon made it sound with some of the directions he didn't like take in Avengers 2, Age of Ultron. And he was very vocal about sort of the decisions that they made. And you know, that one scene in particular where Thor takes off his shirt and gets in the pool and it just kind of doesn't make sense. Spoiler alert for anybody who didn't see that. you know, it's funny. I've never understood.
The Thor taking off his shirt never makes sense, Ashley. I mean, come on. He just has to do it.
I've never understood. You hire people who are great and good at what they do, and then you're supposed to put them in these positions of power where they can make an impact and do what you hired them to do. But then people come in and make these choices that, you know, you don't have the same like film background knowledge. I don't know. It doesn't really make much sense to me. I don't know why you would hire someone great, put them in that position, but then handicap them. And I'm sure that's what happened to Ava, or that's what I would guess happened in these conversations. And she sort of realized she wouldn't have as much creative control as she wanted and was more than willing to back off of what will be a big budget film.
Yeah, super. I think that's going to be a bigger, I don't know if it's a bigger problem, but it's going to be a more interesting issue to watch as the Marvel Universe in general. And as we all grapple with bigger diversity, not only in technology companies, but in media portrayals and other areas. Serenity, what do you have for us?
I also have a little bit of an unconventional pick, which is to say that for people who missed St. Vincent's mixtape on Beats One last week, she is doing it's going to be a recurring weekly thing. And I believe her second episode is coming up tonight, later today at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. The first episode that she did involved an adorable 11-year-old named Piper who likes to dance by herself. Basically, the concept is St. Vincent makes a mixtape for somebody who writes her a letter, and then they have a conversation about the kind of music that that person likes, and she builds them a track list, and then she plays it live on Beats One. It was hands down the first thing that made me really go, wow. Okay,
so
I really get why this has the potential to just be so cool. And so I'm really excited to hear what she has next, what Annie Clark has next, because I think that it's a really fun idea, making a mixtape from someone who writes you a letter. She has very good taste, and I'm curious who's the next lucky participant.
Writing my letter right now. Right now. My pick of the week, actually real-time follow-up, Virgilio Corrado on Twitter says was Edgar Wright was the name that I was blanking on. Edgar Wright, who was the original director of Ant-Man. So my pick of the week comes courtesy of Federico Vitici from MacStories.net, who had a great sort of app tip. Right now, there's no built-in lyrics functionality in Apple Music. Maybe it'll come eventually, maybe it won't. But he had an app called Musics Match with an X in it. And what this app does is it just takes the music that's playing in the media controller for iOS and gives you the lyrics to it. And they have a huge licensed lyrics database. But he discovered by accident that it is already working for Apple Music because Apple Music is playing through the same pipes as other media sources on iOS. So you install this, and I'm using it as a widget the same way he suggested. And if you're listening to Apple Music and you want to sing along, you want to torment those people around you, you just pull down Notification Center, you see the widget, and within a couple of seconds, the widget is showing you the lyrics for the line of music that's playing at that moment. And you can just follow along and either belt it out or, in the case of bands like Aerosmith, figure out what they're saying to begin with. And it's just, it's hugely enjoyable if you are a fan of the lyrics, sometimes the poetry of the music you're listening to. So it's called Musics Match. It's free. There's a larger service that they provide, but just the simple widget is a really cool thing because you can pull it down from anywhere in iOS. It's again, that incredible difference between iOS 8 and iOS 7 in that you don't have to go hunting around for an app to show this. Anywhere that you are in iOS, you can just pull down Notification Center and it's there. And this is just another example of how awesome that is. So those are the picks of the week. And this is MacBreak Weekly. I want to thank everyone for joining us. Serenity, anything cool that you're working on? Anything you want to plug?
More iTunes Match craziness and Apple Music stuff on iMore.com. I hang out on The Incomparable. We're working on The Incomparable Radio Theater on the Air Season 1, which I'm really psyched about. Yeah, I think those are the two big things.
What about you, Ashley? What's coming up?
So my Twitter account is AshleyNH, which is up there. Right now, actually, I'm working on producing a video show with a friend. She recently quit Apple. Her name's Leah Napolitano. And we want to produce like a 10 to 15 minute weekly video show about sort of like tech culture and tech news. And so we just shot our first test video last week before I left. And we're really excited to get that off the ground. So that announcement will be coming like later this summer. Also blog.ashleynh.me. I tend to get out some pieces or things that I'm thinking about.
Yeah, and it is a terrific blog. If you haven't looked at it before, please go and look at it. It is sensational.
Oh, thanks, Renee.
Andy, aside from chipping away at your Apple Watch review, what else have you got? What else you got planned?
As usual, a lot of stuff going on at the Sun-Times. So go to suntimes.com for that. Also, I started a brand new podcast for Relay.fm a couple of weeks ago. It's called Material, and it's all about everything Google. So it's not an Android podcast. It's basically for people who happen to share the same planet as any server that Google is running. So only three of you planetary. ISS, you're off the hook, but other three planets definitely want to listen in.
And you've got, amongst others, Russell Ivanovic on the show with you, who's always terrific. If a Russell totally fake Australian accent.
I try not to. Yeah, it's the other thing where you have to realize that sometimes for humorous effect that you try to do an English accent or something like that. That's another accent that, okay, I'm never going to do that again because now I know someone who actually does that. And I'm also rounding out the trio is Yasmin Evgen. So it's a good thing. Three different people from three very different backgrounds with three very different approaches to Google.
Yeah, it's an absolutely terrific show. And I think only the pilot and the first episode is out, but I've listened to them and they're awesome.
Yep. It should drop out every Thursday from now on. We're going to be talking about Google Wear tonight plus Apple Watch and talk about different approaches towards wearables.
Awesome. And for people who are interested in Debug, we just had Ken Case on who talked about everything from the early days of Next going into Omni. And I think our next episode will get some really interesting people to talk about this whole Safari versus IE thing and see if we can either put it to rest or make it even more controversial than ever. Next week, Leo is still on vacation, so the incomparable Jason Snell will be here hosting. And in the meantime, I want to thank Ashley and Serenity and Andy and Jason. And I want to tell everybody to get back to work because break time is over.